hello, hello, and welcome to the Prickly Pens podcast. We're three friends, three writers sharing not only our writing journeys, but a window into our conversations around the art of storytelling in the various formats like books, films, and video games, and also selective topics that make us ponder or generally piss us off. This is episode
85.
So let's start with introductions.
Hi, I'm Gabby.
Hi, I'm Julia.
And I'm Michelle. Welcome to the Prickly Pens podcast.
Take it away, Gabby.
So this week, we're going to talk about action-adventure stories, or the action-adventure drama. Genre. Which I absolutely love. It's probably one of my favorite genres. I feel like a lot of other genres have action adventure as like a subgenre, but action adventure itself is its own genre as well. And it's not the most well-defined of the genres, like romance or something or horror, but like I said, some of my favorite stories are action adventure. It's interesting to see what gets categorized under action adventure, because I was telling my mom this. I looked up on Amazon just to see what Amazon could, you know,
right,
labeled action adventure in their, at least their book section. And sometimes they would have fantasies, general fantasies. And I'm like, okay, not every fantasy is action adventure. There's action adventure in a fantasy, but that's not pushing the plot. I think one of the lists had like Game of Thrones or Song of Ice and Fire. And I was like, it's more like if you put, you know, Dallas and West Wing and Severance and mixed it in with some fantasy. Like it's court drama with a dragon. It's truly like there's action pieces, of course, in
right
Game of Thrones, but right, truly it's court intrigue.
Right.
It's a lot of moving pieces of political pieces around.
I like how you explained it, like what is actually pushing the plot forward, like what is that engine. So it's mostly
And even they put like Star Wars, and again, Star Wars has action adventure, but it's a space drama, it's a space opera, but it's like it's there's action, there's adventure, but the again, that's not really moving the plot. It's like, you know, you have like I said, the drama of a soap opera with sci-fi characters.
Well, maybe they're just putting all the themes or all the when they give it a label, maybe they're just giving all the beats that particular story.
I agree.
Yeah.
It's like a marketing issue
right?
And I mean, I would say, I guess the classic fantasies are well-known ones, fantasies that I would say are truer to action-adventure. I wouldn't even say Lord of the Rings. I'd probably say The Hobbit, the first story of Lord of the Rings, or prequel, or whatever you want to call it. That's probably more the most action-adventure-y.
Say that he wants to go on an adventure.
Yeah, that's literally what he says. Yeah. So I don't have any. I was like trying to look up online to see kind of the definitions, and everyone, you know, everyone had their slight definition versions, and then the subgenres. But I feel like there's a certain particular types of action adventure stories that I have just come up with myself. This is my opinion, but just again, it's a genre I love. So I've watched a lot and read a lot. But I would say you have the one big one is the kind of the quest. It's pretty much going from A to B. That is the goal. And right. Usually it's, you know, something that's like going to be worth a whole lot of money. Some type of treasure or something.
Some
that's usually
treasure.
What it is. Yeah. And it's like going from A to B, we will go from here to here and get that thing. And usually all the plot is happening on the journey. Almost like an odyssey. It's an odyssey of a story. You have the, I feel like you have the, I call them, because it's a label that you see a lot in video games in terms of action adventure stories. It's called a fetch quest. So a fetch quest is basically when you go to, like, someone approaches your character and they're like, can you get three of these for me? Or can you get this and bring it back to me?
Right.
And then your protagonist is like, okay, I will do that. So then you go and do that thing. And so it's like you're getting something to bring it back to either sell, get a prize,
right,
fix something. So it's like...
like that Harry Potter story,
yeah,
where they were,
yeah,
searching for the Horcruxes.
Yeah, yeah. That, yeah, that would be a fetch quest. And usually, I would say it's different than the regular quest in that... when you're having the quests, like in maybe The Hobbit, is probably just the quest is to get to the Misty Mountains and kill,
right,
the dragon and make, I think, Thorin the king again. And, or he's already the king, but get his throne again. And that is the goal. So you're not going to see the journey back. No one cares about Bilbo going back home. I mean, they show it, but it's like, that's not the point of the story. Meanwhile, the fetch quest, some of the story is the journey back.
Yeah.
It's like, we go there and we're trying to get back. Of course, you have the action-adventure mystery thriller, which is the good old, like, Da Vinci Code, where,
yes,
it's kind of pseudo-historical stuff. Tomb Raider type of stuff where it's like, let's dig up a bunch of old stuff and fight over it, whether you're fighting it to sell it or put it in a museum. But that's, you know, the classic Indiana Jones, the mummy.
Yeah. Artifact quest. Quests,
yeah. Which is probably the most, popular, I would say most popular in within the action adventure subgenre. That's probably what I saw the most on different lists is the artifact quest. For the most part, pretty much based on real historical objects and stuff, and then just kind of tweaked.
Yeah, either based on the real artifacts or the myth around the artifact, and so you could research and find some things about it, but then they take the
that little bit
and escalate it.
Yeah, yeah.
Indiana Jones, Dr. Jones.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like 25% real,
right,
based on a real thing, and then the other 75% is just random stuff they added on. But I love those. Those are absolutely fun. I think that's probably what got me into history.
Da Vinci Code made people go to museums and stare at
the paintings
to find hidden meanings.
For the hidden meanings and for the... because when that book came out, you had the regular print version, but then they came out with an illustrated version, which I bought.
And it's in my room.
It's an absolutely beautiful book because all the paintings and the artifacts that they were talking about in the story, they have the picture of it.
I didn't know that was
so
even available.
Yeah, so it's like you
get to see what he what
and
he based
then
his
you're imagining
on.
That I see where his hand is making the secret symbol.
I mean, I remember on History Channel after Da Vinci Code came out, there were so many documentaries on, like, the paintings of,
paintings.
Da Vinci and
the Last
Michelangelo.
Supper.
And
The Last,
if there's any actual, like, blah, blah, and art historians who are trying to explain, like, yes, there can be symbolism, but no, it's not that. But, it's just...
And then people were going to the Louvre because of the V, the small V touching the big V, pyramid.
Yeah.
And, you know.
And that was supposed to be like what, where Mary Magdalene
Mary Magdalene is buried.
Is buried there under the Louvre.
Yeah. So, but it hits in our desire for certain things to be true.
Right.
So that even if you moved it to the pirates, type of story, we want to think that behind the legend, behind the myth, behind this object, there is a slither of truth.
There, which makes it feel more heavy, more weighty.
Yeah,
I mean, one of my favorite adventure action adventure stories of all time is probably The Mummy.
Oh, I love The Mummy. Oh,
The Mummy. Yeah.
Love it. I watch it over and over again.
Yeah, I've watched it so many times that I remembered the Egyptian curse. Like, I could repeat it in my head.
Oh my God.
I was watching it and I can repeat it. And I was I was like, probably shouldn't say it out loud. But yeah, the fake Egyptian words. But yeah, I love The Mummy. And it made me get really into ancient Egyptian history, but then that also got me really into history overall.
Yeah.
But I think, yeah, that one is probably one of the best kind of
example, you know, based right?
off of Indiana. Yeah. Yeah. Based off of Indiana Jones, but kind of like a more modern telling of it. But yeah, it was really good. And I like what I find interesting with a lot of action adventure stories is kind of how the protagonists, and I remember telling my mom this last night, but it's like the protagonists are always quite brave. They're unabashedly brave. That is not part of their story, is becoming brave. They will usually jump in to a situation, whether it was a good idea or not.
Right.
So their arc may be like them learning to be more tactful in their approach to things, but their journey isn't like how to be a hero. They're already usually,
which is different from the epic fantasy.
Very different.
They're good not point. Trying to be a hero. They're already there. I guess The Hobbit has almost both of those, where you have the dwarves are already heroes by the time you know they're on this journey. Meanwhile, Bilbo's the new guy, and he's a hobbit who doesn't go on ventures and stuff like that. So he's turning into a hero, but he's also naturally brave. The fact that he even goes anyway is a big deal for his character. But that is in a lot of action adventures, I feel like, where they're already there. Like, they're not working up to it.
Indiana Jones is already
he's
already a brave person. And then when they showed the young version of him with River Phoenix, he was also at that point, he was an idealistic, brave young kid,
very brave.
So usually they're trained in something that will then allow them to face whatever they're going to be dealing with. They mostly have the skills, or then they may have a team, depending on if they're by themselves or with a team.
And you have that in like The Mummy, which with Rachel Weisz's character. Evie, she is a librarian, but she has studied at her parents were like historian, archaeologist, or whatever they were.
Exactly.
Like academics. And then she is desiring to be an academic, and she can read the ancient Egyptian and knows the history just as well as anyone. And it's take place in the maybe 1910s, 20s. So you have the thing of like she's a woman in a man's world.
Exactly.
But she can compete with the men just as much. But she's pretty brave. Like, she does stuff quite boldly without any thought. And, is a part of the movie where Imhotep, who is the mummy, wakes up, and she wakes him up by accident. But but he kills a bunch of people. They run away and go to Cairo, and they're like kind of hiding out, waiting for to leave Egypt. And she's like, "We got to go kill Imhotep." And Brendan Fraser's character is like, "No, we don't. We could just go home and ignore this." And she's willing to like stay and fight.
Take a stand. Yeah.
Yeah, take a stand. And meanwhile, the others are like, "We're going to go." Eventually, of course, Brendan Fraser stays, of course, you know, keep her safe and all that. But yeah, it was just one of those where like she's brave no matter the situation. Even if she's naive about it, but she's still
brave.
Willing to do it. Yeah.
I think they have a moral code that is very strong in their beliefs, because if you go back to Da Vinci Code, Tom Hanks' character, who plays a professor of religious
theology,
I forgot his exact title.
Yeah,
but it's like he's looking at our religious beliefs and how we how we interpret it based, I guess, on our faith or whatever. Mm. So, like, somebody, in the beginning of the movie version of the story, shows the trident of Poseidon, and people think it's the devil's pitchfork.
Mm.
But it's Poseidon, and then he shows something else, and it's like, you know, it's based on our interpretation and our beliefs and so on.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So that allows him to then come to this big quest that he's doing, that he's been forced to do, to look at things through a very objective eye. And he's dealing with people who have taken their faith to an obsessive, even, I guess, evil way. And he understands where they're coming from, but he's also the pragmatist in this. But he doesn't have the skills to fight assassins. So he's linked up with the woman who is a police person in France. And so she's the one who has the gun, and she's the one who helps him navigate through the world. But it's his ability knowledge, to right? be very logical, that gets them through the different things. And that was in Da Vinci Code, and that was also in Inferno with Ewan McGregor, and I don't know the woman's name, but that one was dealing with the Vatican and so on.
Which I remember when that came out. I think that came out around one of the popes, just I don't remember if it was the one that died or the one that stepped aside, but I remember around the same time was when like a new pope was being going to be announced. I think it happened like not that far after the movie. So I just remember a lot of documentaries came out because it's like you had the Angels and Demons just came out.
Oh.
And then the whole pope is about to actually.
Yeah.
So people were like,
I said Inferno.
All this.
Angels and Demons.
Angels and Demons.
Angels
and Demons. So it was, just, I remember at the time, it was like there were so many documentaries on like, is there a hidden thing, blah, blah. And I'm like, no, they're just voting on a new pope. Like it's not the special hidden mystery. But it is a cool thought.
Yeah. But in that one, he also needed, again, a police person.
Yeah.
He needed somebody who, the technology and the surveillance and so on, because that's not his skill set. But he has to be able to recall historical religious detail quickly in order to try to save the different cardinals and so on. And getting it wrong, you know,
it's
a costly mistake. That, oh no, this wasn't built here, you know, or they didn't come here or whatever.
Yeah,
or
not at the time.
And there was an element of time, right? They were on the clock, and they needed to be able to figure things out very, very quickly.
They're usually short timelines.
It's very tight.
Yeah, there's not going to go on for years or anything like that.
Let me think about it. Get back to you.
Because even like the Pirates of the Caribbean, it's something where you're going to be chased. So therefore, you've got to get whatever it is you need to.
I mean,
before they get you.
Pirates of the Caribbean is another great example of action adventure. Of course, it has a little bit of the artifact look, you know, artifact quest, and then you have a little bit of the almost Odyssey-like travel as they travel everywhere. But usually it's like, I feel like that one is almost like the goalpost keeps changing. So it's like, first we got to get here, and then you realize like, oh, to get here, we need this thing.
Right.
Or we need to talk to these people. So you go and find those people. They're like, you actually need this. Okay, let's go find that thing.
Right.
Then you go find that thing. And it's just the constant goalposts keep changing.
Right.
Quest. Yeah. It's like that quest. So it's
like a quest. And then a
big odyssey. Yeah.
And sometimes when they're like, oh no, we have to go here. And then they're there and they're like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
It was here, but then it moved.
Yeah. And then there's a lot of betrayal.
Yeah, there's a lot of betrayal.
To help you.
And they're pirates.
So. Right, exactly.
Yeah. Which is funny because I do remember, I think it's the first one where when you first meet Jack Sparrow.
Yeah.
When he's fighting Will or Orlando Bloom, mm-hmm. and they're in the blacksmith shop, and Jack cheats for, like, they have a normal fight duel,
right?
And then Jack cheats, and that he's like, "You cheated," and he's like, "I'm a pirate." Like, it's like a reminder. Like, I'm not. This is not Men of Honor duel moment. Which it's like throughout the series, it's just reminded a couple of times where it's like, oh yeah, they're pirates. They're not like mm-hmm. these aren't mm-hmm. soldiers or like a man of honor.
They have their own code. I wouldn't call it an honor code.
And that one is very, like I said, the goalposts keep changing. So the first one is like, I mean, everyone has their own personal goals.
Exactly. Like
Jack is just trying to get the Black Pearl back, so he doesn't really care. As long as he gets that back, he does not care what else happens around him. And then you have Will is trying to get Elizabeth back. Mm-hmm. Then the pirates, at least Barbossa's pirates, are trying to become human again. And so it's like everyone has different goals. It all, of course, culminates at the same time. And they have to help. Some of them have to help each other to get what they want. But everyone has a different goal.
Right.
I think by the second one, they all seem to be more of it. Everyone wants the same thing for different reasons, but everyone needs the same thing. But the first one, no one, that one's a little bit more like a lot of plot lines that are crossing. They cross at the end, but in between, it's like they're not crossing as much. Yeah. And then, of course, the third one is a big, big action adventure story as they're trying to get all the pirate lords to come together to fight the British, the East India Trading Company. But like I said, that one is, like I said, has a little bit of the artifacts, especially the first one where you have the pirate treasure that curses the pirates who take it. And the second one would be Dutchman's Heart. It's mm-hmm. probably the artifact.
Yeah.
And the third one would be,
I don't remember.
It's actually an artifact in the third one. I don't think there's any particular, I mean, I guess you have the Pieces of Eight, Pieces of Nine. I remember the details a lot. I watched those movies a ton.
Yeah, seriously.
But, which are like these pieces the pirates have to open up the sea goddess, to get out of her human form so that she can help them, kill Dutchman.
You know, it's been so long.
Yeah, I watch them like once a year, at least.
When they were coming out, it was like I would always rewatch the older ones and then then it stopped, unfortunately.
Yeah. And those ones, though, are like, they're not quite the typical, they're not like Indiana Jones or Da Vinci Code or The Mummy. They're not artifact quests in a real world. These are like slightly fantastical worlds mm-hmm. already, because you have, I mean, of course you have the cursed pirate treasure, but then you have the Dutchman who's he's a ferryman of the dead, basically. Yeah. So, and then you have Tia Doma, which is played by Naomi Harris, and she's a goddess in human form. So there's like a very much a, there's mermaids, it turns out, in the fourth one. So it's very much like an already fantastical world with like extra fantastical elements versus a real world, and you just happen to have an object of fantastical power. Yeah. So, but they wrote that like over time, like they wrote that in pretty well, versus the kind of trying to add fantasy very far on the back end. It's like, no, they kept by the second one pretty much. Yeah. They really step it up in the second one when you get when you get the Dutchman. Mm-hmm. It's very much like, okay, we're not quite this is not the normal ocean anymore. Which still looks good, by the way. The CGI of
it stands up to time. Yeah,
it looks really good still. I mean, I would see some on one of the lists. You know, of course, you have like Harry Potter, which I would agree. Harry Potter sometimes is an action adventure, sometimes it isn't. They have adventures around Hogwarts in the Wizarding World, mainly Hogwarts. But in terms of action, it's like the action doesn't really culminate until like the climax of the story sometimes.
That's true.
Certain parts of the book, it just, and movies, it's not a teen drama, but it's like, it is kids in school. It's a school by the end of the day. So it's like you're seeing their adventures in school. So I guess it's an adventure, but it's like school adventure, which is, so I guess a small scale. It's like a kid adventure versus this big, like,
epic,
you know,
world.
Epic. Yeah. And that doesn't come until, like, of course, the last couple stories when the stakes are higher. But, you know, the first four or five, it's like, no, this is just a school that has magic.
A little drama.
And then, yeah, like teen drama where it's like someone likes someone but not telling them and, you know, that sort of stuff. Yeah.
Just kidding.
Yeah. Like, yeah, school dances or something. Ugh. Yeah. Like in the fourth one, the ball. So, yeah, I mean, that's, but that makes sense for the age group that it's catered to.
Right. That's true.
But another artifact story that I love, which is a video game, two video games. One is called Tomb Raider, which has become a movie by this point,
right?
With Angelina Jolie, and then there was another one that came out in 2018. They did a remake.
Or a reboot. Oh, I think you're right. I never saw that though.
I never saw it, but that's because when I saw the commercial, it was shot for shot the video game at one point. Like,
oh,
I watched the commercial. I mean, I thought that was, I loved the game, so like, I thought it was fine. It was kind of cool to see in live action, but when I saw it, I was like, that's exactly the opening of the video game. Like,
really?
And it's almost the exact same story. They changed the ending a little bit, which I didn't like, because I thought the original story was fine. They didn't need to change the ending, but they tried to make it more, the movie tried to make it more scientifically possible.
Okay, got it.
And one thing with the Tomb Raider games is that, she's supposed to find, she's on this island that's off of Japan that has a almost like a curse on it. No one knows that it's a curse. She doesn't believe in it because she's all about science and like those things aren't real. And then over the course of the time she's there, she realizes that it really is cursed.
Oh.
And that the queen was basically sucking the souls out of the women on the island to stay alive. Forever.
Doesn't be sound immortal. Familiar. Like, did I even watch the first one?
So in the movie, they make it that it was like a virus or a disease that like kind of killed everyone on the island and stuff. Meanwhile, the game is like, no, it's just straight up the queen is half dead, half alive, and still sucking souls out. So something like that. So it's like, so the game kept the supernatural element. Meanwhile, the movie tried to make a real thing out of it, which I didn't like. I liked Tomb Raider is notoriously about the something that seems normal is actually supernatural,
right?
Sort of thing. So it was kind of like oh, I wish they kept the the supernatural element to it. It would have been, at least to me, could have kept it more interesting than trying to make it real real as possible. But but it was still, you know, still good. And then you have Uncharted, which just recently become a movie. It's a game, but also became a movie with Tom Holland.
Oh, I didn't know it was a game.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Yeah. It's a very good game series. It's very, very good. But very, like, Indiana Jones-esque, very Tomb Raider-esque. But instead of being pro-museum, like Indiana Jones or even Tomb Raider Lara Croft, she's a historian, so she's like, everything should be in museums, we should study things, blah, blah, blah. Uncharted, he is a treasure hunter, so he does not care about trying to preserve the stuff. He's trying to sell it and become rich. So he's a Tomb Raider, basically. Which I never got, because I was like, I don't know why Lara Croft's thing is called Tomb Raider when she's technically not a Tomb Raider. Meanwhile, Uncharted, he's a Tomb Raider. But... But yeah, and that one has a little bit sometimes that things have slightly supernatural elements. But that one is slightly more realistic. Like they're trying to make it slightly more realistic than Tomb Raider is.
Pulls at the heartstring with the brother. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. But it's definitely different approaches. Like you have thieves, basically. Mm-hmm. They're like professional thieves that become good versus, like, you know, Indiana Jones, where it's like a person in a museum who's already good.
Right.
Just trying to preserve something. Yeah. So it's like two different story arcs. But still very good stories. If anyone has a chance to play the games, and if you play games, I would definitely recommend playing Uncharted. It's very, very good. Different than the movie. They changed the characters a little bit.
Oh, which, they did?
Yeah. They changed the personality of the characters.
Oh, okay.
So Mark Wahlberg's character, did you see it, Julia?
Yes, I did, yeah.
Okay. So Mark Wahlberg's character, Sully, him and Nate have a father-son relationship in the game.
Oh.
So it's more, it's a sweeter relationship.
That would be sweeter.
Yeah. So there's a part in the movie where Mark Wahlberg leaves basically Nate to die or whatever. Or not to die, but to get arrested or whatever, something like that. And in the game, that would never happen. Never like, you would never leave. No. Never leave Nate. So, yeah, it was just like, oh, I kind of wish they kept the them having a sweet, close relationship. But I guess, I mean, it makes it more interesting for the movie.
Does it? I don't know.
And I would say the most recent, I mean, like I said, there's Amazon and other places have a nice list of fantasies that I would not consider action adventure, but they have them on the list anyway. But I would say one recent fantasy that came out that is action adventure to me, truly, Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
I just saw it when you mentioned it. Oh, it's so good.
It's so good.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's why I say I think it's marketing that screwed it up.
Yeah.
Because it's a solid...
It's a solid story.
A solid action adventure.
Yes.
From beginning to end.
Yeah.
I just don't even know why it didn't hit.
Yeah. Right. Great characters.
Who with Dungeons and Dragons, that had classic action adventure beats in it.
And that was definitely also very much a quest.
Yeah.
Oh, very much a quest. Yes.
Yeah. But like I said, marketing sucked because I didn't know what the movie was about.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I think they relied on people knowing.
Yeah, because
Dungeons and Dragons.
I knew. I saw the commercial and I was like, oh, that looks fun.
Yeah.
And I know Dungeons and Dragons. I like Dungeons and Dragons. So it's like if you already knew it, you're probably going to go watch it. Mm-hmm. But for the for the audience that doesn't know Dungeons and Dragons, they probably wouldn't automatically go and want to see it, you know?
And right. I felt, to me, when I was watching the trailer and so on, because I didn't know what it was, it felt like it should be a kid's movie, but these old adults were playing in this kids movie because I was getting mixed messages as to what it was. So
yeah, no, I didn't get it.
Is it for kids or is it for adults? Because you've got Michelle Rodriguez and someone who's like, a certain generation is going to know who she is.
I mean, it felt very much like for millennials, I guess, my age group.
Yeah.
Because it's like, we even know all those actors. Most of the people around my age know Dungeons and Dragons. We don't have the stigma Dungeons and Dragons has for the whole satanic panic thing.
Yeah, that's
probably more people in the 80s and 90s. And it's like, I didn't have that. So it's like catered to my age group.
Right.
But, you know, they can't put it at the beginning with an asterisk. This is for people born between 1990 and 2005.
Yeah. But that's where I feel the editing, the trailer... You know, like how you have some really good trailers.
Yeah.
People who can make good, really good trailers.
Really good
get the theme essence. Or the beat right of the movie.
Of course.
I don't feel that this happened.
Yeah.
It did not.
Yeah. I mean, I think, too, you still have quite a big amount of people, at least that I've seen online, that are probably around probably older than Gen X, so older than you guys, but that are still quite anti-Dungeons & Dragons, and I still see a lot of probably your generation that are anti-Dungeons and online.
Yeah.
So it's like...
Or maybe you make the Dungeons & Dragons the small title,
yeah,
but then you make a bigger title,
yeah,
so that it's not screaming Dungeons & Dragons. Yeah.
Right.
Because I think the small title or the subtitle is... has like Honor Among Thieves or something.
Yeah, I think something
like
that.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you did like Honor Among Thieves : a Dungeons & Dragons story.
Right.
Maybe a little different than it might be approached.
Planning too much or you know, like I guess gambling too much on the fact that with Stranger Things, I think the Dungeons & Dragons topic kind of popped up again. And since those guys love Dungeons & Dragons,
right. Yeah.
Maybe just having that as a title of the movie would draw
everybody.
Yeah.
But you still got to tell us what it's kind of about, dudes.
Yeah,
I know.
I guess from the commercial, like if you don't know Dungeons & Dragons, you wouldn't get it. Because, I mean, even, like, explaining Dungeons & Dragons to someone who doesn't know Dungeons & Dragons feels complicating. Even though it's not that complicating of a concept. But when I try to explain to people, they're like, so wait, what? And it's like, you know, I have to keep explaining, like, well, it's this.
Well, that's why, with it being on Amazon Prime, you know, Amazon puts all these trivia notes onto the movie that you can see and... A lot of things that they'll say is in the game. I wouldn't know. I wouldn't have picked up that thing there is from the game. And, you know, it's an important part of the game and so on. For me, just watching it, it's just another character or just another object. I didn't realize that that's a thing in the game that people try to get and so on. So,
Yeah.
And I love the characters. They were so flawed.
No, they were great.
No, I absolutely loved everything about it. Character, story, the plot, everything was great. I didn't see any weak point.
The pacing was really well done. I mean, it was really good.
And I love the, when, the guy from, what's it called? It's a Netflix show. The black guy.
The guy who played the wizard. I can't remember
Bridgerton.
His name.
Yeah, Bridgerton. The guy from Bridgerton. When he came up, his scenes were... So I laughed when his scenes came up because I thought they were so funny. And when they were going on the bridge and he's like... You know, he's like, you walk two paces forward and then you do blah, blah. And it's like going through this long sequence of events to try to get over this bridge, which really happens in real Dungeons & Dragons campaigns. That's a real thing. That was a reference to like the dungeon master will make a overly complicated puzzle and no one will get it. So it's like that they would have to fix it as, you know, as the game goes on. But yeah, it was just like small references like that. I'm like, that's cute. It's like to the game. And if you, again, it's like if you know the game, then it's funnier.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you don't know the game, it's still just a generally funny scene.
Yeah. I mean, I played it when I was little, but I don't really remember like all of that stuff. So, but it was still a great movie. I mean, you know, you don't need the references to.
Yeah.
But I love the fact that they're in there. So people who know it really well can chuckle.
But yeah, that one's definitely very action adventure-y, very quest. That one's probably very much a fetch quest adventure.
Yeah,
like go get this thing to fix this thing.
One person I wanted to bring up for the action adventure is JF Penn, and we've had her on the podcast before, so you can go through the episodes and find her episode because she's pretty prolific.
Also known as Joanna Penn.
Joanna
Penn. It will be shown as Joanna Penn in our podcast.
And she has been in the indie publishing business since, I think, 2011. And has had a successful career in it, continues to have a successful career. And she's got two major sections, which is nonfiction and fiction. And she just published her nonfiction in Writing the Shadow Self. Like, her background is in psychology and theology, and she frequently mentions Jung, and apparently he talks about the shadow self or whatever. And so she wrote a book about using that for her writing, and so on. So you can check that out. But her first series was a Arcane thriller, which is an organization. Arcane is an organization, and I forgot what all those letters mean, but but it is set around the religious artifacts. And so in each book, she's done, I think I counted 12 or 13 books so far. 12 books. And each book is set in a different place, set around different set of religious objects or stories. So the first one is Stone of Fire, and it's about the tomb of Jesus. There was an earthquake, and the door broke open, which is how they knew he was gone, I think. Don't correct me. I don't want to know. We're going with what I think I remember from her story. So the door to the cave broke apart, and one of the apostles took stones from the cave and gave it to each apostle. And then these stones got handed down through time. So, and around the time that the door broke apart, a comet was going around, and this comet is coming back. And so if you gather these stones with the addition of the comet, miracles will happen and people get healed or whatever and whatever, whatever. So the heroine of the story, who is the person throughout the entire series, she is a professor of psychology and I think theology. So probably a little bit of Joanna in there. And she studies at Oxford, just like Joanna did. And so she's bringing all these different fields of study into the story, and she the bad guys come because they need these stones, and they have tracked down people who have been the keepers of the stones. So no one knows the other keeper, and her father, who was I think he was an anthropologist, had gotten the stones from, I think, a grave or something, and he gave his twin daughters the stones. And she wears it around her neck, her sister wears it around her neck or wherever, and the sister and her niece get kidnapped because they want the stone from the protagonist. And so Arcane is this secret organization that on the outside looks like a type of museum type organization, but deep down under Trafalgar Square is this robust business or secret organization that even the Prime Minister doesn't know about. And they are there to collect different artifacts and keep it out of the hands of the villainous organization Thanatos, who seems like he might have been originally with Arcane and then broke off. So and one of the people she deals with, Jake, he is from Arcane, so he's going to be the one providing backup. He's giving her access to their the ability to use their planes to get around, because a lot of times, because it's a short timeline, she's got to get from, you know, maybe Oxford to Rome to France to wherever. And so that's what they are providing for her. Of course, they want the stones also. And this partnership goes on, like I said, for 13 books. And what's interesting in it is that because it's tied into, like I said, stories, whether true or not, but religious belief systems and so on, it's like you could go in and you can research. So when Joanna's writing about these stories, in the beginning, she hadn't gone to some of these places, but eventually she started traveling and she went to like cathedrals in Spain. So when she's talking about a particular scene, she's remembering that maybe there's a door behind the altar and maybe there's some secret stairs and you run down there and you come out on this street and so on. So it gives a lot of credibility to the story that maybe it's like a what if, you know, yeah. Like the Da Vinci Code. What if Mary Magdalene had gone to France and had this daughter, and, you know, on and on and on. So it's the same kind of thing. And she said she liked Dan Brown's stories and she read and basically studied it. And so she came up with her own story and with her own characters. And the woman who is a professor was in the military. So she's got fighting skills and
Gabby
was saying, you know, she comes already packaged, ready to handle whatever's coming at her. She's willing to sacrifice her life. She is willing. And because they have come after her family, she is willing to do anything. She's not going to wring her hands over having to injure or kill somebody. And that her belief system isn't quite there either about the religious artifacts. Like, she's not overly religious. She may not even believe in anything. So for her, it's just a stone. She doesn't even think that the stones have any power. And in the stories, Joanna gives it a kind of like, here's a vague thing where it could be coincidental that, you know, fire came out the sky, or it could be an actual environmental reason that the fire came shooting out of the sky at that time. So it's I have enjoyed the series, and she's sometimes she stopped to write some other series and everybody's like, when are we getting back to
go back?
So she did a huge hiking tour in Norway. And I think on her website, she said that she was starting to write something. I think it's for Arcane. So I'm looking forward to it because every time she goes on a trip, I know that that's going to get worked into a book, into a story, which series, or, you know, she did a pilgrimage walk and that was for a nonfiction. But it's really fascinating how she goes about gathering her information and I guess as studying theology in Oxford, she does know quite a bit to tap into to make these stories come alive.
So I hope she comes back on the podcast. And you reviewed that so well. I mean, I read that book and you just made me want to go back and reread it again.
Well, I want to remind folks, not remind, because you don't know this, so it's not a reminder. It's more of a FYI. For a short time, she's got the box set of 1, 2, and 3, which is Stone of Fire, Crypt of Bone, Ark of Blood, under the Arcane series for 99 cents. I'm not sure how long it's going to be, but yeah.
By the time this episode comes out,
I don't know. She might have had it for a while. Because a lot of times, if you follow her and you get on her newsletter, she will probably give you the first one free anyway, Stone of Fire. But over time, she'll have different sales. And more than likely, because she is writing the next episode of the Arcane Thriller, that some of these books will go on sale. So, you know, check it out. And last name is Penn, P-E-N-N, and her first name is Joanna. But it's under J.F., as in Frank, J.F. Penn. And Arcane Thrillers.
And, but yeah, action adventure. I think, like I said, it's my favorite genre. I mean, I definitely thought that when I got into history stuff when I was younger, I thought I would be, you know, fighting mummies and climbing through tombs. And no, it's a lot of research in a library, but I still enjoy it a lot. But definitely, I was like, as a kid, I'm like, oh, I will be like Lara Croft jumping around. It's like, no, definitely not. and nothing you dig up has any curses or anything. just a bunch of old stuff. But yeah, again, I think it's like a very exciting genre to me, but I think because my mind just goes with the fantastical elements and the adventure. I loved the idea of like discovering something. And I feel like, I mean, we're a time period in human history where like a lot of things have already been discovered. So there's not much to go and look up. Yeah. Unfortunately, I don't know, but it's just like, it's not as robust as like the age of finding old stuff.
Right.
A lot of stuff has already been dug up.
Yeah. Well, I guess you can come at it as it's been, the research was incorrect.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that
you're fixing the research.
We're going to fix it.
Yeah.
We're going to fix it.
Yeah. Still in a library, though. Right. You're fixing it in a library.
In a library.
But, yeah. But yeah. And I think it's a fantastic genre. Like I said, the lists on different websites or Amazon, like I said, not every fantasy is actually action-adventure just because it has action-adventure. But like you said, that could be like a tagging thing or marketing thing.
I think so.
Like if you like action-adventure, you might like this. So yeah, that's right. Of thing. But the true essence of action-adventure is not, Game of Thrones or something.
And it's what keeps you turning the pages.
Yeah.
Or keeps you watching a movie or keeps you playing a game. It's
what's going to happen next, and
right to make you not put that book down, which is how I was with Da Vinci Code.
Yeah, Da Vinci Code is just like the more, especially when they get to the point, well, at least in the film, when they get to the point when they're trying to Ian McKellen's character, and he's giving the full explanation of the whole Mary Magdalene thing. It's just like, what? Yeah. And you're just like, I'm just listening. I mean, oh my gosh.
I was a convert. By the time I was done reading it, I was like, oh my gosh, who knew? What? And then as I do the research, because at the time, I don't know, like if Google was that robust in terms of going and digging up stuff.
Right.
But I remember, and it probably was, but I remember as I was looking things up and so on, then I realized that no, he had used the premise from another book, which they sued him and he won. But he used the premise from another book and then like certain secret organizations that he said that he used in his book, though they didn't exist or that it didn't do all the things that he said it did. And it was like slowly they were dismantling my whole excitement that I had of discovery.
Well, it's like
you made it sound so believable. Yeah, so real.
Yeah. I mean, it's like
I was ready to go dig up at the Louvre to find Mary.
It's like in how in Angels and Demons, and they have the Illuminati and in the story. Like the Dan Brown stuff, it's a hint of a little bit of like magic and stuff like that. Meanwhile, it's like the Catholic Church is so anti-magic that they would never dare to do even fake magic. So it's like that would never happen.
And the Louvre wasn't Mary. The Louvre was the Grail.
Oh, sorry. Yeah,
the Grail was the Grail. Mary was in Scotland, right? Wasn't she buried with those people?
In a church.
I was like, okay.
And then it went, but it showed like the line that she walked, as if she would walk all the way by walking by her legs to France. Like,
but here's the funny thing with all of that kind of stuff is that it does help tourism.
Oh,
because, definitely. Yes.
Because they had somebody put together all the places that.
Yeah.
Were part of the Da Vinci Code story.
Oh. So that you could take a tour.
So you could do the tour of those buildings.
No way.
Yeah. And the Louvre said they got so many people coming after that book
just
came
to go
out
follow
and
the
movie came out.
They must have been so grateful.
But it's the same thing like Harry Potter.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, we went to any tour that said
Harry Potter
was filmed here.
Yeah.
We were on that tour.
So I went to Oxford. I went to different parts of London.
So when we went to, it was Oxford, right?
Yeah, we went to Oxford.
And we went into the dining hall and they're like, and this is where it was filmed. And we're like standing there.
It's Oxford dining hall.
Oh my God. And it's just a freaking dining hall.
Yeah. Of a college.
But it draws you. It draws you. You wanted to experience a little bit of that same magic.
Right. Yeah.
So that's the
or even the train part. The main big train station in London. Is it which one? King's Cross.
Yeah.
Like in the middle of the big 9 3/4 is platform 9 3/4. It's in King's Cross. So they have a sign that actually is there with a half fake trolley that's going through
the
wall.
Halfway through the wall.
Yeah, but it's funny because you have tourists who stop and like take pictures and stuff. Meanwhile, it's a normal train. Like people are trying to go to work as you are standing there in large groups.
But, and then the store is in there.
Yeah, this is a Harry Potter store in there. And then every summer where the train is supposed to show up, like in the books, they do an announcement like now you're boarding the platform 9 3/4 and you have bunch of Harry Potter fans.
It's packed
every year.
Wow.
So I mean it definitely gets
for the Da Vinci Code, I think where the church is
it's
like out in the middle of nowhere. So
of France.
It's not like you'd have to really make a trip. But the same thing with Outlander. They created a map of
there's now a tour.
This is where she went through the stuff.
Yeah, there's a tour of the Highlands of where you can go in the Highlands of Scotland.
Oh no,
because a bunch of people have gone.
Yeah. Oh.
They did a car tour.
I've seen people who do it on there's now a bus tour. I see people do it on on Instagram where they're like, we're taking the bus tour to go through the Highlands of where she walked around.
Yeah.
And people are doing that.
Yeah. That's so funny.
So Joanna's, it's the same thing.
It's the same thing.
I can go to Oxford and stand right where she said and where the bookstore is because it's so detailed.
Yeah.
Wow.
Where's that bookstore that you're talking about?
Where's her movie deal? That's what I want to know. Let's get her a little map too.
I forgot to mention another big action adventure that how could I forget to mention? National Treasure.
Oh yeah.
Which is set in America about American if George Washington was a Mason and hidden a bunch of treasure. And a bunch of other American founders.
That's with Nicolas Cage.
Yeah.
I was an extra on that movie.
Oh,
cool. Oh, you were.
I played a Moroccan photographer tourist.
Now I gotta rewatch it to find you.
I don't know if you can even pick me out. You know, I tried one time and I was like, and I have, it's so funny because they were like, don't look at him in the eye. Like they were like, don't do it. And, you know, we weren't allowed to have like you take pictures or anything else like that. But hello, since I was playing a tourist, I brought my camera and I freaking took pictures. And when I was pretending to take pictures, I was taking like pictures of like the statue we were in front of. And then I managed to catch a picture of Nick Cage and his stunt double. Cool. No, I was being all slick. So it has a special place in my heart.
Yeah. Because I mean, that I forgot that one is a very, very much like an Indiana Jones, but set in America.
Didn't mean something because it was in D.C. and Virginia that I know those places.
Right. It did feel like I mean, I remember a lot of documentaries came after that of people saying, no, America doesn't have like a hidden treasure of just random stuff, but in D.C., it's buried somewhere. But it did feel like because I remember learning in like history class, especially when I took like not honors, like AP history classes.
Yeah.
And you hear more of the more hidden stuff of the revolution where they did a lot of like secret codes and things like that, like the hidden stuff that is now forgotten. Yeah. That stuff is kind of cool because it's like, oh, there's, you know, a building that used to actually be a hidden thing during the revolution that now is just a bakery. It's like, that's kind of cool. And you see like a plaque in the back that, you know, says where someone important was. Right. So it's like those type of little things are cool. It's like, oh, I didn't know that. Or like, oh, I didn't know that ship was to be sent to the Americas with a bunch of weapons to fight the British or something like that. So those little things that I didn't know were kind of cool to learn. But it's not as mystical as as like Da Vinci Code. But it is a fun, but there's nothing hidden in D.C. Like it's nothing. It's pretty well known. People, nothing's there.
Just let it go. Yeah. It's
fine. I know they're trying to be like, people were trying to be like, let's try to find the hidden messages of Benjamin Franklin, and like, no, he doesn't have any messages. There's no hidden anything. But
he had other things to hide, but not that.
Yeah, right. But that's action adventure.
It's great
genre. Go watch all those movies.
Yeah, we gave you a good bunch to go listen to or look at or play.
See again.
Yeah. Yep.
Mm-hmm. So all right. I am going to do a mishmash of things, which I wrote down, so I won't be rambling. Just wanted to highlight one book, and that I just read is Enough by Cassidy Hutchinson. And she is the woman who, it's again related to the January 6th committee hearing. Mm. And she did her memoir after she had talked, whatever you want to say, at the January 6th committee hearing. She was the right-hand person, assistant, whatever her title is, with Mark Meadows, who was the chief of staff for Trump. And she also had close proximity to Trump. So she gave some insight about it and how at the end, because of the January 6th issues, that her conscience told her to speak up and speak out. It's an interesting, she's 25, 26 years old now, 27 so maybe. So it's not like her memoir is like decades. Yeah. It's not decades deep. So, you know, her family's conservative, her father's weird. And I was just wondering if weird people, you know, end up making their kids do, or, you know, it's, and I've been benching a bunch of different types of stories where a lot of people have weird parents, and weird is my big word for abusive or just weird. And he was a conspiracy theorist, and I was just like, why? You know, they're in Jersey. So it's not like he was living out in the middle of nowhere. It's like, how do you grow up being so anti-everything? Anti-government, this whole pioneering, you know, we do it for ourselves kind of thing. And it's just, and it's on a toxic level. So he he did a lot of manipulative things to the family and to the kids. And I just like, why, you know, and she grew up again with that, I guess, that not necessarily conspiracy thing, but very conservative, and moved up the ladder of the power games in from the legislative offices over to the executive branch. She's very smart, very strategic, and she was the gatekeeper to Mark Meadows. My whole thing, I know that everybody's praised her for coming out and kind testifying. Of put her on mm-hmm. heroin status. But when I read it, I felt like if January 6th didn't happen, she was fine, even when something made her feel
like uncomfortable.
Uncomfortable, or, questioning, right.
Right.
That
like
she
it
was
took
okay.
that to
it
prod
took that,
her.
Right.
And to be like, oh, wait, this feels
you've got
wrong.
All these principles, right. But then you were willing to go with it. And then even after, you know, not the January 6th, but she was more like wanting to go work directly for Trump because she felt that he needed good people around him. And she was somebody who could do it and help him. And so I'm not one of the fans of hers reading this and putting her on a pedestal for it. But I did think it was interesting. I read it through the library because hell no, if I would buy anybody any of their books and give them any of my direct money. And but it is it's an interesting read.
I was going to say, do you think her motivation to do the testifying and to do the book was... I don't know if, like, obviously, I mean, she might have been trying to do the right thing, but to move from testifying to doing a book, obviously, mm-hmm. that's going to be a monetary type of strike while it's hot type thing. So I just look at motivation.
Well, the thing is, most of the book, it felt, you know, at that point when she had decided to testify and so on. And she got her own lawyer. She decided to get her own lawyer because before she was under the Trump's people.
Oh, good Lord.
And like a lot of them, they end up perjuring themselves or whatever. And then when they get their own lawyer, then they come clean. So her problem was that she was considered low enough that nobody really wanted to step out and do pro bono for her. Mm. And a lot of these lawyers are like, we don't do payment plans either. Oh, so she literally was stressing over finding a lawyer. Of course, she's in this expensive apartment, I guess, downtown or whatever. So she didn't really have any money. And then when you went up against the establishment, then nobody's going to help you either.
Right.
So it ended up being Liz Cheney who recommended these lawyers that she went to.
Oh, wow.
And they did it pro bono.
Oh, wow.
And she needed security. She needed to be hidden from people who were coming out. So she never, at one point, she never went back to her apartment. She literally left all her clothes, everything at the apartment, and her mother had to go pack her stuff up.
Okay, so she did put herself out on the line.
Yeah, she did have to put she did have to put herself out on the line. She did have to, I guess, do some soul searching too. But at the end of the day, she still wants to be in D.C. She's still back in D.C. She still wants to be in politics. And she realizes that some of the things that were done to her out of anger from the others were the things that she did when somebody was on the outs. You know, it's like there is that awareness that it kind of came back full circle.
Right.
How you were treated. So, you know, at her the age that she's at, there's a, you know, with good health and so on, there's a lot more potential for her to do. Okay. You know, a lot right. more productive okay. things to do.
Maybe she so rethought her whole
maybe,
ideology.
And maybe not. Because, but, okay. but it is interesting. And again, the book ends with her father being weird. I just don't understand. I don't understand him. I don't understand parents like that. I just... And she's, you know, she was good with his name in the book. Cause I would have, but of course he's not my father. Mm-hmm. So I have no loyalty to this person. So I would have just dragged his butt through that book, but it wasn't about him. he's just awful.
Yeah.
So, cause she went to him for money. And he didn't give her the money, you know,
wow.
but I don't even think he understood what she was doing or why she was doing it because right. he was such, so into the Trump, you know, Kool-Aid.
Machine,
so,
right. Mm-hmm.
But she, I was like, this is your daughter, help her. But nope. Anyway, so check it out. It's Enough by Cassidy Hutchinson. And it was published September 2023. So I got it through the library. And the other thing that's not even related to books, but we just came out of Thanksgiving for the U.S. And this is about food, but this wasn't my Thanksgiving meal either. I just discovered this woman. So... the video is called Cooking with Ash, and it is on YouTube. And she's a Guyanese woman, Indian ethnicity, and she now lives in Connecticut. So maybe you'll run into her, Julia.
Oh, yes.
And she has a lot of recipes that I'm familiar with from Guyana. So my brother recently had someone visiting him, and they were cooking curry, I think curry chicken. So he calls me and he's like, oh, there's this way that, you know, he's like, I'm doing it the way the Indians do it. And when with curry, at least Guyanese curry, which is the best, by the way, and this is my podcast, so I don't care about anywhere else. Guyana's curry is the best. Thank you. But so he said, because the way we would cook it is we would rub the curry on the meat and then fry it in the pan or whatever and cook it. But the way the woman was showing him who visited, and then when I found this woman cooking with Ash, is that they take jeera, which is cumin seeds grounded up, and garam masala, which is from a bunch of different spices. And I guess you can put in how much you want in it or where you want your flavor to come from. But it's a mixture of cinnamon, peppercorns, cardamom, mustard seeds, coriander seeds, cloves, nutmeg and mace, and it's grounded up. And so usually the jeera goes a long way. So it's like 2-1 between the jeera and the garam masala, and then curry powder. And I use Lala's curry powder because my mom used it. So it's the best. And Lala's curry powder is coriander, chilies, black pepper, cumin, mustard, fenugreek, garlic, turmeric, salt, and some other stuff. And it's all grounded up. So all these are powders.
Wow.
And you put it in the pan and of oil, and you kind of cook it in this paste. And then you pour water and you boil it down until the water disappears. And it's a thicker paste. It makes it so much richer, and I just loved it. She kept saying this word, which I was like, okay, she said, I'm going to bunje the curry. And I was like, oh, what the heck is bunje? I could, when she showed it, I know what she's talking about, which is to cook. You put the water in and you're cooking it down until it's a heavy paste. And then you put your meat in and you stir it up. And she's like, I'm going to bunje the beef or I'm going to bunje the lamb. And so I looked on Google and I was like, okay, first of all, I don't even know how to spell bunje. But I think I found, I think I found the word, and it's B-U-N-J-A-L or B-H-U-N-J-A-L. But it is referring to cooking the curry until there isn't any sauce left. And then the curry hangs, kind of clings to the meat or whatever it is you're putting in there. And you can cook meat or you can cook like chickpeas or whatever. So I was so happy to find her account because it reminded me of home and about and of all the different foods that my mom would cook with no freaking recipe, so I could never learn how to do anything.
My mom's a son.
And, and so she I was refuses. So happy. Right. So I was so happy to find this woman who was breaking it down with the things. And so the next thing on the list is to try her roti, which, again, Guyana's roti is the best. Trinidad, sit back with your bussa roti. It's not the same as Guyana's roti. So, again, my podcast. So
I love it. Keep going.
But the roti is a quick thing, and she's got the recipe, and I'm going to try that next because – oh my God. So far I did curry lamb and curry beef and Gabby ate it all up.
Yeah. I love Guyanese curry. I'm the same way. I think Guyanese curry is the best, but with the second place being Indian and then everything else is a drop off after that. But
fighting words. Yeah,
I know, although right? I would say I like maybe Thai curry is third. Yeah. After that's a drop off. Yeah. Okay. So it's Guyanese, Indian, Thai, everyone else.
Yeah. But the funny thing is, I sent my brother this link, Cook with Ash, and I said, look at her stuff. She's because I said she's doing the same thing that, you know, your person showed you. And I said, but it's, you know, she's even more, gives a little more tips.
Yeah.
And so when he looked at it, he calls me, he goes, you know, he's like, I looked at her and I saw her hands and I said, yes. And here's the crazy part. He was like, I looked at her hands and I knew she could cook because she had those hands. I was like, and I said, people who can cook have solid hands. It's like their fingers aren't fancified. It's not long fingers, graceful fingers. It's not manicured. It's like solid, I can bake bread hands. And and I was like, my mom had those kind of hands. My grandmother had those kind of hands. I don't have those kind of hands.
I have baby hands. But I can cook.
But you know, like people who can just like be in a kitchen and they can just, you know, whip anything up and it just tastes so good. Yes. And so, but it was just funny that he said that because I was thinking that when I saw her, I was like, oh, she's got good hands, good cooking hands, whatever that means.
Oh my gosh. I'm so hungry right now. It sounds so good.
So if you're into trying something new, like I said, her videos on YouTube, she's got a ton of stuff. Guyana's food is a mixture of Indian, it's a mixture of African, it's a mixture of Amerindian, which is our indigenous culture, and British, because the British, of course, were there. And so in my house, we had foods from all those cultures. And it's just absolutely delicious.
When my grandmother would make me food, it was all that stuff. Right. So
yeah,
oh. I so like when I go to England, there's a lot of food that I just like. It's a lot of comfort food because it's food I grew up with.
Yeah, my mom was very much into her British version of stuff.
Of like, yeah.
And
yeah.
Then my father was, his people were from Suriname, which is Dutch, formerly Dutch Guyana. So there was some Dutch things that came through.
Yeah.
And then my mom and her mom were from Madeira. Her great-grandmother was from Madeira.
Which is off of...
Portugal.
Yeah, I was like Spain, Portugal.
So I think that's where they got their hands from.
They had the Madeira. The mother hands. My hands, but I can tell you, not good.
But I'm sure your mom has good hands.
She does have good hands, actually.
She's got good hands. I'm telling you, the people with ballet-type hands, fingers, and stuff, they're not good cooks. I don't care what they think. Look for the solid hands.
Solid hands. That's so funny.
There you go. Turning it over to you, Julia.
Okay. Sit back and relax and welcome to Julia's Corner. Today, our topic is 49 plus interesting vending machines from around the world. So I expect both of you to pipe up because I'm sure you guys, I consider world travelers. So this is what I found on interestingengineering.com. So they must know what they're talking about. It was written by Christopher McFadden, updated August 17th, 2023. So not that long ago. So, but this whole idea came about because one of my sisters was recently in New Jersey, you know, just like visiting really quick, and they ended up running into a vending machine for the Cake Boss.
Oh, I've seen those,
right? And you can buy
apparently
slice.
They're not good. They're not that cake. Great, but supposedly right, they're not that great.
This is what I expected. I want feedback.
But
get a cake, a whole
a
cake.
Slice, yeah,
cake.
It's supposedly. They're from his place in like Vegas or whatever, and you get a slice from his store. But apparently, people are like, it tastes like store bought cake that's been colored and they put his name on it, and it doesn't taste like. It's a vending. I don't know how you
because
get
of the preservatives.
Yeah, I don't know how you get probably. Like fresh cake over. Yeah. Like you would have to bake it fresh that morning and put it in the vending machine to get.
Yeah, cake. I mean, I don't think it tasted fresh, but it was cake.
Yeah, so, but people were complaining about that, at least in Vegas, because Vegas has a bunch of them apparently all over the place.
Mm. Oh, so, okay.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny because I was looking through this list and it was really fascinating. For example, so even though, you know, it says from around the world, you know, there are some things that are in the States. So right now, or they don't clarify where they are, but there was a Calvin Klein underwear vendor. Which
I mean,
interesting.
Japan has underwear vending machines.
So, did you find really weird vending machines? Like, while you were, I mean, I have never seen that before.
Korea has a bunch of vending machines that you see on the street, but most of them have like knick-knack. Sort of like things in them, like little toys or something. Okay. Well, sometimes they have like cell phones and stuff. Like they have some major big items. And then,
so why am I getting an underwear?
Oh, they also have some really good coffee vending machines in Korea, like coffee ones that just like get you an espresso. It's delicious, and you can just wake up like a cheap $1 espresso.
I get that. You know, they used to have like those kind of machines, like in hospitals and other places. Mm-hmm. Like growing up, I remember like the cigarette.
Yeah, I know they have them in Japan. There's two versions of them. You have one that's for like dirty reasons, and then you have for like men getting panties and stuff like that. But there's one for
even think of that.
Yeah, but there's one that is for actual, like, it's mainly for homeless people or people who are really can't afford or whatever, and it's only, I guess, equivalent to $1. To get like a pair of underwear or pairs of underwear. So
didn't
it's like
think
there's
about
there's a practical thing for people who are don't have a whole.
I feel like
words.
If somebody brought that here, they'd break the thing open definitely. Just to get just all to the get, underwear.
Definitely. Right. It wouldn't work. None of this works in America. You need a society that doesn't.
Our culture is so wild.
I'm saying it doesn't work.
Right, right. Yeah. It's so wild that we look at something like that and, yeah.
But yeah, like in those countries, they'll have them. I know Japan has them. I mean, you can, like, if you say you're, you know, hard money at the moment, it's like you can do a whole lot with a vending machine. Like, they have cheaper. They have pretty decent social care, but, like, also.
I was going to say, like, those poor people have to shell out a dollar.
Yeah, they have. They already have decent. Care, but if you are like someone who's still struggling in general, you can get like an affordable meal pretty easily compared to here. Like, you can't do that here very easily.
There's a vending machine picture, and I don't see that it's in English, so I don't think it's in the United States, but there's a vending machine for live crabs.
No.
They're not dead. They're kept alive at around 5 degrees Celsius.
No.
I wouldn't trust it. I wouldn't trust it.
I wouldn't trust any meat.
Yeah, I wouldn't trust any meat.
I don't care what.
Unless it's like, unless I'm in Japan. Maybe Japan, but because they do keep up the vending machines, not anywhere else. Mm-mm. But Japan. Well, in my high school, we had a popsicle vending machine.
That's fine.
I like that. That's cool.
That's fine.
Yeah. So, yeah, it would have popsicles and ice cream cakes.
See, they should put that in the DMV.
Oh, yeah, there's solid $3 to $5, but
yeah. Our ice cream sandwich was like 50 cents.
I know.
Ours was like,
bring around the card at school. Did you like one?
No, ours was like,
I'm dating myself.
It was probably like $2 to get a chocolate ice cream popsicle.
That's highway robbery.
I never went to it. I went to the vending machine next to get a Coca-Cola, but I just yeah. But yeah, they have ice cream ones.
Well, that's good, because the next one is rhinoceros beetle vending machine. For as little as 100 yen,
I know those
you can
beetles
get your
with the giant horns.
Yes, it's a low maintenance pet.
Why would I want that as a pet?
Why would I want a bug
or a potential money making gladiator?
Do people compete their beetles against each other?
I guess so. Where is
that
the yen?
That seems kind
used?
Of barbaric.
What country is the yen? I don't. Okay,
Japan.
That's Japan.
Those Japanese people. They really have like a variety of vending machines then.
I don't think of bugs as high intelligent animals, but I also don't want to have them fight each other.
They're living in there.
Yeah.
They're alive.
They're alive. They're in there in their little cuckoo thing before they get shot out the vending machine. That's insane.
Yeah.
That is crazy. I mean, they would have to come back and like feed them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Gross.
I mean, you would have to like open them, feed them, put them back in. That seems like a lot of work just to keep up this vending machine.
Maybe they are also cold refrigerated.
but a lot of those kind of things have diseases on them.
Yeah.
By the time you did all that, you're probably creating.
Unless they farmed them. So there's not necessarily.
Because it's like, I remember in Brooklyn, they were selling those little turtles, like really small turtles.
Yeah,
those have like people buying them, and they said
they have E. coli.
They're like E. coli
shells.
And hepatitis something.
Yeah, most turtles have hepatitis and E. coli on their shells.
And they were telling people not to buy them, but they were selling them on the corners in New York back in the day.
So you see like a turtle out, and people like pick up turtles at a lake and stuff. They wash your hands immediately. Don't touch anything.
No, I'm not touching those things.
I didn't.
It's
know
like
that.
Koalas. Koalas have chlamydia. Almost all koalas. Yeah. So don't touch a koala.
Okay, well, I did not expect to go down this dark path with my upbeat topic.
Keep going, Julia.
Okay, all right. It's just getting worse. There's a bra machine.
I've seen that, yeah.
Okay.
And it's in, again, thanks, Japan.
It's like the underwear. Well, I guess I would say I do, again, the homeless thing, but then also someone said, Aaron Brown Line, when they talked about it, they said if you had like an accident, like you spilled something on your pants, you can get a pair of underwear real quick.
I mean, I get that.
So there's a practical,
but
like,
you see,
thing
I don't,
get.
I don't wear clothes just from the store like that.
No,
so I think it's more specific. Of a it's a quick run. Like
I still don't want to put anything near my coochie.
Well, it's in a package. It's not like hanging out.
No, they are packaged, but
yeah, they're packaged. Again, like, you don't but know. I think it's like I remember one time I spilled like. I mean, it was water, but it was spilled water.
Yeah, I mean, on my crotch,
and it's like, oh yeah. Crap! Or like, yeah. I have to.
I mean, I've had accidents,
but so I guess it's like it's
I
for
guess
the
if
quick.
I have to.
Yeah, it's like for yeah. the quick. I think it's for the emergency.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's a dollar.
All right.
I don't think you're supposed to keep it.
Yeah. No, it's probably throwaway type things, but
yeah.
Toilet paper vending machines.
That's not
That's
bad.
That's fine.
That's fine.
I would say it's too late at that point.
I'm just being honest. I think you're supposed to get it before you
go in.
Yeah,
go in.
Okay, well, I did not realize that.
I mean, I guess if maybe you went and then you're like, crap, I'm out. You went halfway and then you ran out
well,
the bathroom
sure,
and got some
I'm
toilet
sure
paper.
I'm sure something like that is like at the you know, when you walk into one of those bathrooms.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
probably at the
beginning.
Front of the bathroom.
Oh, yeah. When you walk know? In, first walk
yeah.
in. Well,
yeah.
I expect to be provided toilet paper.
Yeah, you usually are. Also, Japan does have the smart toilets that have the bidet in them, so you may not even
oh,
need
right.
it technically.
All right, there are so many. Wow. There's even a Tyson chicken.
I've seen that. I've seen the food ones. The food ones, supposedly the food ones are really good though. Like they're genuinely good.
I think it's one of those, if I'm in an environment where it's the normal thing, it might take me a while, but I'll eventually
like
trust.
Like I think Japan people, it's notoriously like that's part of their culture and they don't, like it's not like here, people would destroy the machines. We can't have good
well,
things.
Well, it's like I don't trust the sanitation of it, but okay. It's like when I was in England, I ate an egg sandwich. I would never eat an egg sandwich from anywhere.
Oh, absolutely not.
But
no. But in England,
it's you know,
typical,
you can get
normal,
it,
yeah.
and it's fresh,
yeah.
and it tasted fine, and
yeah.
because it's a thing
okay.
in England.
Yeah.
Off the
but
street,
I think,
though? Like, what are you talking about?
It was in, like, a sandwich shop or at Gabby's university.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They had,
yeah.
Okay, that's
but
fine.
But I wouldn't normally
yeah.
pick up
yeah.
sandwiches.
No.
I don't.
Right, like food, like actual.
Yeah. But everybody was grabbing their stuff, and it took me a couple days, and then I grabbed it.
If it's in a location where there's a lot of people, like, all mm-hmm. the time, then the mm-hmm. turnover would be...
Yeah.
It would
yeah.
make me feel better, like, oh, you know, they must sell a lot yeah. out of this machine and put it in.
Yeah.
So it doesn't
But the bread was
there?
Fresh, the bread okay. was soft.
I think it would... Like you said, it depends on the location. Like something like Japan, where they have the culture with the vending machines, I would
oh, right,
believe
right.
that
would
they are fine to use and eat
yeah.
and whatever.
Right.
In America, if I saw the same thing, I wouldn't do it.
Right.
But if like street food, where I am in Maryland, if I saw something at the side of the road, I'm not touching that. Are you insane? But
yeah.
if I went to like New York or LA, where they have like the taco trucks that are like always
right.
around and
right.
everyone's eating them, like,
yeah.
oh yeah, I eat that because
yeah.
clearly there's a, like you said, a high turnover. People
high
are fine.
Yeah.
Well,
people
I mean, it's
it.
Like
yeah.
a street vendor in downtown DC in front of the mall is doing mm-hmm. so much business
yeah.
that I know that you don't
exactly.
have the hot dogs from yesterday
yeah.
exactly.
floating around in that water.
But like you said, something where I am in Maryland, it's
right.
like, oh, hell no, I'm not doing that. Are you insane? Like, that's just
so
not...
I think that determines how I pick and
choose
for the vending
yeah.
machines.
How you gamble with your life, you mean? Two more I've picked
uh-huh.
out. One is gold. There's a gold machine in Dubai, mm-hmm. of course. I was like, where is this?
Yeah.
Where you could buy gold. Which,
okay.
I mean,
yeah.
we would have to. No, it's not very interesting to me. So.
Yeah, same.
Maybe because
I mean,
can't afford it.
Japan has a website where you can, like you make an account, but there's a website for a Japanese company that, for people from outside of Japan that want to play with the vending machines, they have, you can remotely play them like from the US online so that you can win the vending machine and they just mail it to you and you're paying for the shipping. And people have won like iPhones and things like because their vending machines have a ton of really good stuff. Like they have, like you said, there's
okay,
so many.
What's the website?
I don't know what it's called, but I've seen people play it. I have to find it, but I can
okay,
send it to
you.
You.
What is that, a game?
It's it's not a game. It's a legitimate like, it's, I forgot what the website's called, but
so I'm buying the stuff.
You're not buying anything. You're making an account, and almost you pay like what you would pay to play a vending machine. So a vending machine game. $1 or whatever. And then you play the vending machine.
Like the claw? Like the claw type thing?
It's a different vending machine. Claw machines or the pickup machines.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, yeah, you're remotely controlling it from U.S. to Japan.
Yeah, and, please find that information.
And you can you can win what's in the machine. They'll just mail it to you and you just pay for the shipping.
Okay.
So the company is just, they don't keep up the machines. They just take care of the shipping for you. Mm. But Japan is like the company that owns the machine. They're, of course, the ones fixing everything. But right. it's just this, website that you can play it remotely because the Japanese vending machines are so popular.
Oh my gosh, and that's so cool.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah. So people have like won legitimate stuff. Mm-hmm. Like people show their hauls and they're like, oh my God, I didn't actually think of, I thought it'd be a scam or something. But they're like, nope, they actually send it to you and you win your thing that you
I guess
won.
I would use that's where you use a prepaid card so that it's not tied to your bank account.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you put that card into the system, and that way, if you do get a scammy,
it's not too
thing
bad.
That you're only out whatever is on that card.
Yeah,
I know.
So that would be my advice.
More careful, because I like on my Facebook feed, I'm always seeing like outlet, you know, this mm-hmm. outlet and that outlet, and there are a couple times where I was like, oh yeah, I'll get this, and I'm like, months later, I'm like, what happened?
Yeah.
I have to contest the charges. I have like two of those. But anyway, last but not least, mashed potatoes.
Through the vending machine.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
No.
I mean, again, if it's in Japan, I would do it. But no. That's it.
And for me, it's a no because I don't do dairy.
That's a hard pass.
It might have milk.
I can't trust your ingredients.
Yes.
Unless I know exactly.
Although a lot of Japanese people are lactose intolerant, so maybe.
But they don't seem to have a problem eating the nonsense.
That's
either.
True. They do eat. Quite a lot of stuff.
No,
because they have a lot of milk and stuff.
They do have a lot of milk. For a country that's notoriously lactose intolerant, they have a lot of milk products.
You have to think about all of that stuff too when you're when you're talking about this. But yeah, there was a whole bunch more on the list. Very interesting. I had no idea, but most of them are overseas. So
There was one I saw that had Kobe steaks. Like you can grab one for dinner to go home because people, I guess in Japan,
they're so expensive.
I guess when you're in Japan, they're not as expensive.
Oh, gotcha,
because
gotcha,
it's already
gotcha.
There. So, and it doesn't give you like a ton of meat. It's just like a portion size. So, but if you're in a rush, it's like just quickly grab the Kobe steak, go home.
Picking my meats is important.
Yeah. Well, I think the culture is you already have good cut steaks already. Yeah. You don't have to.
I have to look at the marbling.
Because I think the problem is that we grew up in the West where we're jaded and the society has screwed you over several times. Meanwhile, I don't think Japan, they're getting screwed over with their meat cuts as much as we are. So I think the butchers in Japan seem to be quite
well, I guess it's the good. Quality of the meat because the marbling in meat is about what the animal ate.
Right.
And so so one piece of meat versus another could be quite different. So when I am looking for my ribeye, I'm trying to see all the marbling in there. Yeah. So I need to, unless they're, you know, it depends on how they're showcasing it. Yeah, can I see the front and the back before I hit that button?
No, I totally get it.
But yeah.
And just the freshness would be a concern. But yes, that is interesting. But there's so many more things. It's amazing. Just I had no idea.
Well, and I guess depending on culture, if, you know, especially with the foods, if you're busy and you don't have a lot of time or if you are living by yourself, you can go to a vending machine and basically get your entire
meal.
Dinner.
Right.
Yeah.
With you picking out the different things and then
I mean, there's people who have vlogs of them when they travel to Japan or they live in Japan. They're showing like you can spend less than $5 for vending machines and get a whole meal with no issues. Like they're Again,
they're so ahead of us.
You can't so do that in America.
Yeah.
But I would love if you could do that in America. Oh, but you can't do any of that in America.
Well, one guy, he was at a restaurant and he's like, this restaurant is great for people who don't want to talk to people.
Yeah, if they don't want to talk to people. They have the restaurants for single people.
So you sit and like you don't even have to deal with the waiter, but everything comes in like single servings.
Yeah.
And you have a little hibachi grill in front of you. And you're in a booth.
Yeah.
You got a little TV.
Yeah, they usually give you TV.
And you just pick watch TV what you and want from the screen. Yeah. You hit what you want, and then your sauces are there. You pull a drawer out from the table, and you have your utensils.
Yeah.
And you cook and you eat.
Yeah.
And you don't have to
you
talk
watch
to yourself.
TV and
yeah. then when you're done, you leave.
Yeah.
You pay and you leave, and it wasn't expensive.
Yeah. Really? No, yeah, the stuff isn't expensive. So
it was like $7 or something like that.
So like
for a meal.
America, this can never happen. Meanwhile, I'm like, oh man, I would love this. This is amazing.
Well, you stopped me at cook yourself. But other than that,
they have ones that are pre-cooked though. They have ones that are just cooked.
Okay. I mean, grilled
meat is delicious.
Grilled
fresh,
meat is so
fresh
good.
Grilled meat is delicious.
Oh, delicious. I'm so hungry, guys. I'm so hungry.
Okay.
Well, so good. I wish they had one here.
We'll let you go eat because we're about done.
Yeah, we should wrap up.
So, Julia, what do we say?
Stay prickly.
All right. Bye.
See ya.
Bye.